Today we would like to give a presentation of Monte Carlo techniques, which actually means statistical simulation for developmental data. I don't know whether Anderine, with whom I did a lot of this work, likes to gamble in life, and if so, I don't want to know it. But anyway, I don't want to gamble, so it means that I like to sort of compensate for that by using the gambling aspect in my work or in our work. Just an overview of what we will present today. We will begin with a short description of the basic principles of these Monte Carlo techniques and also of some of the basic techniques that you can use. And we'll actually demonstrate the use by showing you three examples of using Monte Carlo simulation in doing statistical work in developmental psychology. One is actually a very simple sort of basic application, differences between groups. We will deal with averages, but also with things like extreme values or changes in the distribution. And the second is about another important problem in developmental research, which deals with the problem of stability, which is actually related to the issue of repeated measurements. And you can repeat measurements in young children, but you can also repeat measurements over observers. One is observing the same data set as the other, is scoring it, rating it, and then it's an issue of reliability, and in children it would be an issue of stability, but that's a second illustration. And a third illustration will be about longitudinal data, which are sort of notorious for, which are quite problematic from kind of standard statistical point of view. And we believe that these Monte Carlo techniques can give you all kinds of approaches that are actually very flexible. So let's begin with the basic principles. Why should one want to use these techniques in developmental data? There's like a whole world of statistical techniques. Why is it necessary to come up with these new? Well, they are not really new, but they are quite new in developmental psychology. One of the reasons, maybe one of the main reason, is that most of our data sets are actually quite strange from a statistical point of view. They are often very small, like 20 measurements or 15 or 12 or 32, whatever. And sometimes the most interesting ones are actually very small data sets. For instance, if you're studying things that are occurring not very frequently. Sometimes the data sets are quite unbalanced. They are not normally distributed or whatever. Sometimes there are lots of dependencies in your data when you have like repeated measurements in children, but not too many, like you would need in time series techniques. So most of our data sets are quite strange from that point of view, quite deviant. And the other aspect is that many of the developmental questions that we ask are quite difficult, quite complex. And one of the problems is that we often adapt our questions to the kind of techniques that we have. We would like to know all kinds of things about relationships and about discontinuities or about changes, and we don't really ask these questions because we don't know how to statistically test them, because there are all kinds of methods to do the statistical testing. But then we are confronted with the first problem: our data sets are too small and so forth. So these are two big problems in our field. And one of the major advantages of these Monte Carlo or statistical simulation techniques is that they can actually handle any type of data set, even very small ones or very unbalanced ones. The technique is very flexible. Another major advantage is that with these techniques, you can actually check any test statistic, any criterion you're interested in, not just averages or whatever, or relationships or correlations, whatever you can invent in terms of a measurement, in terms of a distinction between two things or more, can be tested with with these techniques. And the third looks more like a disadvantage, but I see it as a major advantage of these techniques, is that they actually necessitate explicit thinking about the null hypothesis. The null hypothesis, I mean, this is a joke basically, but the word says it's one of the sort of the most forgotten aspects of why they call it the null hypothesis. It means nothing, but I believe that we should really think very hard about our null hypotheses, the kind of alternative against which we test our hypotheses. And this is something that you're obliged to do if you're working with these Monte Carlo techniques. There are actually two different in terms of basic techniques, two different principles that you can use if you apply these Monte Carlo techniques. The first principle is a principle of random permutation or reshuffling of your data, which actually means that you're testing all possible or an approximation of all possible rearrangements of a given set of data. It's like you have a deck of cards. There are several players, and one of the players says, well, they always gave me the bad cards, you know, and then by means of Monte Carlo technique, which is just reshuffling the cards, and there are just 52, if I'm not mistaken, in a deck of cards, you can actually statistically test that it's probably not true that this person always gets the wrong cards. So you just rearrange these 52 possibilities, and then you're actually applying random permutation techniques. And technically, it's actually random drawing from a finite set without replacement. You take it out, and then it's gone. And the second major technique that you can apply is random sampling, which means that you actually constitute or draw all possible samples from an infinite set of cases, like drawing from a deck of cards with replacement. So there are actually two versions of random sampling. One is that you resample from an existing finite set, but with replacement, especially if you have an existing data set. And the other, which is more widely used, is that you draw from existing distributions. And you have an equation, for instance, for a normal distribution, and you draw from that distribution. The third aspect is that if you apply these techniques, you really have to formulate a very explicit model of the null hypothesis, which, as I said, could appear as if it were a disadvantage, but it's really an advantage of the technique. How can you do this? Well, there are some things that you need. The first thing that you need is Excel. Actually, it's widely known that I do everything with Excel. I brush my teeth with Excel. I do everything with Excel, or actually a lot of things. But anyway, so this is the first component. You use Excel. If you have Excel, you have to install an add-in for Excel, which is called PopTools. It's not for popular tools, but it's for population tools. And it contains a lot of very powerful equations, procedures for randomization and doing all kinds of things that you'll probably never use as a psychologist, but anyway, it's all in the freely available add-in. And the third thing you can, it's not really necessary, but it's recommended that you install the world famous, at least the place where I live, the world famous Paul's Functions, which just contains a few additional functions, and we'll show you some. And then actually a very important aspect is that you should activate the imagination module in the statistical part of your brain, because that's something which is in most cases turned off as soon as you have your first courses in statistics. The first thing is you turn off your imagination module, and then you forget to turn it on. But you really have to use your imagination to use these techniques. We will begin with a first example of actually very, very basic techniques. And we'll go to the first Excel file, which is gives here an example of an extremely simple data set, which consists of 5 measurements. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, those are the values of the measurement. As I said, there are two techniques that you can apply. One is resampling, the other is random permutation or reshuffling. How can we randomly shuffle or randomly permute these five data points? Well, first of all, we select a range which is actually just as big as your data range. And in that range, with the range selected, that's very important, we type equals shuffle, and then you type this bracket, and then you select your data range, and then you close the bracket. And then, and this is very important, in Excel you actually have to enter it in the form of an array formula, which means that you have to do it with Control Shift Enter. So if Andrine presses Control Shift Enter, she has now entered this shuffle equation. And if you now press on the F9 button a couple of times, what you're going to see is each time a reshuffling of the five data. And you always have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but they will appear on different positions. And we'll see several applications of this extremely simple technique. So this is the first principle, just a random permutation across five cells or whatever, or two columns, whatever you want. I mean, it's really very flexible. The second technique is resampling. Actually, you do exactly the same thing. Select a range which is just as big as your data range, and then you add you enter the equation equals resample. You open the brackets, and then you select the data range that you want to. Actually, this little fellow should go away. But anyway, you'll see. Go away, fellow. Okay, yeah, and then you end the whole thing again, enter the whole thing with Control Shift Enter. That's important. And now you have a resampling of the original data set. Now, each time you click on the button F9, then you recalculate the whole thing, and you can see the difference between what you're doing if you're reshuffling and if you're resampling. So you're taking samples with replacement. Like in this particular case, for instance, there's twice this number 3, and the number 2 never occurs. If you do it again, we'll probably find another. Twice the number 3, 2 times number 5, and so forth. So it's actually making samples on the basis of the distribution of your data. Actually, this is basically all you have to know, and if you now turn on your imagination module, you can basically do all kinds of statistical things. But of course, in reality, it's a bit more complicated. Another thing you can do is actually use with equations for known statistical distributions. And in PopTools, you will find all kinds of distributions, which I will discuss later. Maybe if you select the first cell, here's an example of, and then maybe just double click so that we can see. Here's an example of how you can draw a random number based on a uniform distribution with a minimum of 0 and a maximum of 10. The equation is d rand int for integer. And if you just enter or whatever and press F9 a couple of times, you'll see that the equation just randomly draws numbers between 0 and 10. That's a very simple equation. Another way in which you can actually enter the equation is by doing it in this way. Here you write the minimum in the first cell and the maximum in the second, and you just have a reference to both cells, okay? And that makes it actually very flexible, because in these two cells you can enter variable things, for instance, that come from another equation, which means that you can draw random numbers from patterns that change all the time, if you have an explanation for that. And it's basically the same as really entering the equations. Now, a widely used equation or form of distribution is a normal distribution. For instance, a normal distribution of test scores which have a mean or an average of 100 and a standard deviation of 15. Now, we're going to show you. You can enter the equation equals d normal integer form of the normal distribution with 100 as your average score and 15 as your standard deviation, and then enter, and then you just click on F9, and if you do this like 1,000 times, it will give you a nice normal distribution with average 100 and standard deviation 15. Which is actually a great statistical tool if you want to teach things like sampling or sampling biases to your students. You can let them work with this equation and do it like, for instance, 10 times, calculate the average of the 10, and then do this like 100 times. I mean, if you can really make your students do that, anyway. And then they can experiment for themselves with things like the distribution of averages based on random samples taken from the normal distribution. And in PopTools, there are a lot of alternatives, distributions like the Poisson distribution or the gamma distribution or whatever, but most of the distributions that we are using are the uniform distribution or the normal distribution or other distributions that you construct yourself, but that's something that we will show a little later. And here, maybe just for your information, there are some more examples. For instance, here we have like a long resample based on three scores, and you actually enter the resample equation and you just copy it, which means that you can resample 1,000 cases based on only 3 or 4 or whatever occurrences. But this is something you can do or read for yourself if you're experimenting with with a file. And here's an example, for instance, of dependent data where Paul and Henderin and Sabine have taken two measurements. And of course, Paul should not be compared with Henderin, or vice versa, and Henderin not with Sabine. So they are really dependent data. And if you maybe if you click on the two, if you select the two, these are the data. If you select the two references here, you see that we have shuffled over the first and the second measurement, but within each subject. Okay. Maybe you can just select it and then zoom in so we can have a better look at the Okay. Now if you double click on the first cell here, see, then you see a shuffle H5, I5, which are my data for the first and the second measurement. So we shuffle within a person, and we actually shuffle the first and the second measurement, but while keeping each of the persons apart. Anyway, this is not something that I will explain here, but there are many cases in which you can actually use this. You cannot change part of an array. Okay, just escape, because, yeah. So this is actually just a little basic stuff to show you the equations and what you can basically do with it. But there's, of course, more. If I'm not mistaken, we are now going to the PowerPoint presentation again, and I'll give you a first example. Actually, the example that we are going to give is an example that, especially the first example, is much easier to do with just a classical t-test. But we'll show you that you can do much more than what a t-test could basically do. It's about differences in emotional expression, and it's part of Andreen's research. Maybe you can tell a little more and show a little. We also have a little movie about the experiment.
Okay. Data are about emotional expression during a play situation. The data are of 2 and 6-year-old children, and they are of different social metric status. So they are. Of a popular status, an average status, or rejected status. And we score the emotion on a 10-point scale. What we calculated was the total duration, the percentages of total playing time of positive emotion. And we have a movie of that. So here we have two children playing. They have four groups of toys on the table, having a good time. Okay, and the question was, are children of different statuses different in percentages total duration of positive emotion?
As I said, you could. It's actually much easier if you do this with a standard test like a t-test. But anyway, the goal of this little exercise is to show you how a random permutation reshuffling can be used to study differences between groups. But now the most important thing is that with a random permutation, you can study differences not just of mean levels or averages, which is easy, but also, for instance, in terms of extreme scores. Are there more extreme scores in this group than in the other, even if the averages are practically the same, for instance? Or hypotheses about differences in the distribution. Is this group basically more variable than the other group? So the way we will do it is by means of an Excel file in which we have the raw data of the emotional expressions. It will first show the structure. Here's a picture of two other boys. Again, it's the same situation, and here's an idea of the kind of data that we obtained. Here are, actually you cannot really see it, but maybe if you just move the graph a little bit, and then I can say it's like this. These are the time codes. Maybe you can just zoom in a little bit so we can read the bit. Okay. So this is what the observers were actually scoring from second 0 to second 27.86. The child was neutral. This is Dutch. Actually, it's pseudo-Dutch. Never go to the Netherlands and tell somebody that you are rede nega, because it does not exist. It's sort of reasonably negative. And they were certain, actually the observers were certain that it was reasonably negative. Anyway, this is the kind of data, so it took an enormous amount of time to actually score the data in this way. But so we had these data, and then we made there were two observers who did this work, and maybe you can just show the graph again. And it gives a graph which is, there we are. This is the time in seconds, and these are the emotions. Like, this is an example of an observation in which there are pretty much positive emotions, just a little negative, over 420 seconds. Because if you, I think if you scroll down a little bit, we'll probably see the data on a second by second. Yeah, actually it's here. Yeah, it's on a second-by-second basis. So we made a little a program that actually transformed the time code into seconds. Okay, so we have 420 seconds because we took 7 minutes for each play situation. Now then we turned the average, the total duration. You can easily calculate the total duration of positive emotions in this particular case, but just taking counting the number of seconds in which the children show the positive emotion. Maybe you can zoom in on the data so that we can see what we got here. So there are three groups, three different social statuses: rejected, average, and popular children. We were collaborating with a group of researchers who were interested in that problem. And for instance, there's one rejected child who showed positive emotions almost 25% of the time, but also a child who showed almost no positive emotions. So this is the distribution for the rejected. These are the data, a total duration of positive emotional expressions for the average group. And as you see, there's a little more average children than rejected. And there's one, actually just one more popular child than rejected. And those are the data. Okay, so the first thing we want to know, of course, is, and that's what the literature predicted, popular children show more and also longer positive emotions than rejected children. So let's first see if it's true. I mean, of course, we know we've already calculated it, and it's not true. That's one of the problems, anyway. But so we'll first enter a simple equation for the average. So it's the average for this whole range of rejected children, and then we enter. And then we simply copy the averages to the other cells. I mean, this is all just elementary Excel work, but anyway, maybe it's difficult to see, but the figures tell you that the average duration popular of positive expressions here is 0.13 in the rejected children and 0.08 in the popular children. So that's less. So we would like to know whether the difference between the percentage of positive emotional expressions in rejected children and popular children is statistically significant. So what we do here is we enter a very simple equation, which is the average of the rejected minus the average of the popular. Okay. Now we are going to use a resampling technique, and the easiest, the most practical way of doing this is by just copying the whole data range and pasting it over there, for instance, because then we already have the structure of our data set, because we are going to resample or reshuffle based on the structure of our data set. So what you actually do is select the range, which is just as big as your data set, and we enter the equation equals shuffle, and then we select the whole range where we find our data, bracket and control shift enter. Why are we doing this? Because our null hypothesis is that it does not matter whether you're rejected, an average, or a popular child. The emotions, basically the data, come from one big distribution, and it means that you can just assign, for instance, this value to a rejected child or to an average or to a popular. It does not matter. The null hypothesis says it does not matter. There are just individual differences. And your random permutation sort of conserves the structure of your data exactly with the same percentages, the same distribution, and also in terms of the number of subjects here. Okay, now each time you click on F9, a new difference between the simulated rejected and the simulated popular children will occur, okay? So what we're going to do now is we will calculate, we will do this 1,000 times, for instance, and then we will count the number of times that our null hypothesis produces a result which is as good as or better than the result that we observed. And now that's where you use pulse functions. It can also be done in PopTools, but of course I prefer pulse functions. So you take Monte Carlo simulation, and here we have a pop-up window. The first window asks you which values do you want to recalculate with the probabilistic procedure. You click on that kind of little bar over there, and it's of course this value, because this is the test statistic of interest. Is the simulated difference between simulated, rejected, and popular children, okay? So this is what we want to recalculate. And then you go to the second window, and you tell the program with which criterion it should be compared. And that's, of course, the average which you have observed. And then the only thing it needs to know is where it should leave its results, which is done in the third window, and you just click on an empty cell over there. Yeah. And then it will recalculate 1,000 times, and it will give you, if you're interested in that, the 95% interval. You can ask for descriptive statistics or whatever, but we are going to leave that for the moment. And then you just click on OK, and it's running, and there you have the result. And let's now look at the p-value. Maybe you can zoom in on the whole thing, so that we can take a better look at the kind of thing that it produces. So it tells you that the average difference is very close to zero, which it should be. It gives you the difference between actually the 95% interval, but this is the most interesting thing. The simulation tells you that in 48 of 1,000 cases, the result was as good as or better than the observed result, which gives you a p-value of 48 divided by 1,000, which is 0.048, let's say approximately 0.05, which is the classical statistical boundary for statistical significance. This can, of course, very easily be done with a t-test. So why would you want to do this? Because you have too much time, and this takes more time than doing a t-test. Anyway, this is the first thing you're interested in. Let's go back to the data and take another look at the data. Actually, yeah, we can take the application window here. Okay, and maybe you can zoom in on the data again so that we can take a better look on the data. And then we'll see that it seems as if the rejected children have more extreme percentages. It's like the upper values, there are more high values in the rejected children. Also, a lot of very low ones. But like the maximal values are here in the rejected children and not in the average and in the popular. So what we would like to know is there a statistical difference in terms of extreme values in the rejected children in comparison to the other groups. So then we go to our worksheet, and we will enter a simple equation which will give us the number of cases which are bigger than 0.15. That's just 15% of the time. It's just a boundary that we've chosen. You can also use 0.2 or whatever you're interested in, because that's like a lower limit of the things you're interested in. So the equation is equals count if, and then what you're counting is this whole range with the empty cells, okay? And then you have and then the criterion that you want to count is bigger than 0.15. And then you close the quotation mark and the brackets, and you do enter. And you see that there are 6 cases in the rejected children in the data where the percentage is bigger than 0.15. If you enter 0.2, you probably get another number. But of course, you see that there are less rejected children than average, so we're interested in the percentage children with the score. We will edit the equation and actually divide it by the number of cases in the rejected group, which we can do by entering the equation count, open the brackets, and then we select the same thing again, and we close the whole thing, and then enter, and now we have a percentage which says that in 46% of the cases, the value is higher than 0.15. And now you can simply copy it to the other cells and take the difference between that percentage in the rejected group and the popular group. And then we see that it's a very big difference, 0.31. That's a very big difference. Now we would like to know whether, because the null hypothesis tells us that there is no difference between the rejected average and popular children, so what's the probability that just random reshuffling of the data will produce a difference in terms of positive extremes, which is as big as or preferably bigger than what we have observed. Now it's very easy. You just copy the whole thing here, and you paste it here so that it actually refers to your reshuffled data set. We'll do the same procedure, same Monte Carlo procedure, and then we'll try to find out the probability that this number of extremes is just based on whatever. I mean, it's just random. It's just accidental. Well, it's the same p value. I guess that's just also an accidental thing, because each time you rerun it, it will give you small differences because it's a simulation procedure. If you really want to do the series work, you should do it 10,000 times. But anyway, I mean, it's just would not take you 3 seconds, but 30 in this particular case. And you can do the same thing with the standard deviation, but we are not going to do that because I think otherwise we will run out of time. But it's the same thing. The equation here would be equals the standard deviation of this, and then you make a difference between the standard deviation. Whatever exotic test statistic you would like to test can be tested in this way. You could be interested in middle values or differences between extremes or whatever, or 82 percentile scores if you're interested in the 82nd percentile for whatever reason. But anyway, so actually you can test virtually anything, and that's one of the major advantages of this technique. It's about time now to go to the third example. So the first thing I've tried to explain or try to demonstrate is that the major advantage of this technique is its incredible flexibility. It will conserve the structure of your data, and you can do just this is actually by means of by way of summary of the preceding example. You can use a reshuffle technique here, but if you can also use other techniques like resampling, but you need to think about your null hypothesis. Why are you doing this, for instance? But this would lead too far. Anyway, we'll give you a second example, which is on the reliability of ratings. Maybe you can tell a little more about the data set that we used here.
It's about the same data of positive emotions of two children who are playing with each other. And we have rated the emotional expressions of, what I said, 2 6-year-old children of different sociometric status. And we coded it during 7 minutes of play. And now, the codes are given by 2 independent observers. So the question is, are the observers reliable?
Yeah. The goal of this particular demonstration is to show the use of random permutation in the calculation of flexible measures of reliability, because reliability is one of the sort of forgotten issues also in developmental psychology or psychology in general. Almost everybody uses the Cohen's kappa actually without really knowing what it does. I mean, everybody uses it because everybody uses it. But this is a way in which you can defend your own null hypothesis. The null hypothesis we're going to demonstrate is a little bit, I'm not going to say stupid, but it's a little bit simple. But anyway, it's an illustration of how you can set up a null hypothesis, and you can make more complicated null hypotheses in order to compare the reliability of your raters. So we go to this Excel file reliability, which will give us the data from actually the same type of data. See here, we have the same type of data as in the previous file, but now we have a first rater who actually rated the tape, and a second one who also rated the tape, and there are actually very slight differences, but we'll see what the actual differences are. If you just scroll down a little, we can see that here are just the times, and here are the codes. 6 means neutral. This is actually a child that was coded, who showed a lot of negative emotions, and I don't know if you can see it, but anyway, the blue is the code of one rater, and this kind of pink or whatever color is the code of the other rater. So most of the time they agreed, but they agreed basically with regard to the neutral emotions. But anyway, we'll show you a simple way in which you can calculate a kind of agreement measure. And the measure that we would like to demonstrate is not so much an agreement, but it's a measure of distance between the two raters, okay? So, for instance, this one says, second one, 6, rate of two says second one six. So the distance between the two equals the absolute value ABS of the code of the first rater and the code of the second rater, which is zero. Okay, and then you copy this to the 420 seconds by just double clicking on the little black square over there. Now maybe it's better if we first go down to you can in this file you can here is just a sum. It's 27. It's just a sum of distances for the 420 seconds. Okay, which in this case, so it's a sum of the whole range from E6 to E425. Now, we would like to test the reliability by comparing the real observers with an observer who has a kind of general knowledge of what happens, that most of the cases it's going to be neutral, and just a few times it will be negative or positive. So he has a very general knowledge of what happens, but he's a sort of blind observer. He's sort of blindfolded, and he has this sort of frequency in somewhere in the back of his mind, but he's just assigning ratings on a random basis, which is not a very good theory of a blind observer, but it's a kind of theory which is on the basis of Cohen's kappa, actually. So we're going to simulate it. Actually, Andrine will first fill the whole range with X's because that makes it easier to select it. You select the whole range of 420 seconds here, and you type equals shuffle. And then we take, if I'm not mistaken, the frequencies of the first rater as a kind of database for our null hypothesis observer. Okay? So this is like a representation of the frequencies that should be expected if you have some kind of general knowledge. And now with the control shift enter, you have a completely random reshuffling of the codes, but there are lots of sixes. And now we will calculate the distance between our null hypothesis observer, which is this row, and a real observer, which is rater 2. It means that we compare a real observer with a kind of completely blindfolded observer with some general knowledge of the frequencies. And by sort of recalculating the whole thing, then we should go down to where we find the... Okay. Now here you enter equals the sum of all the distances. Okay, and now for this is 151, and the observed distance is 27. And we will actually calculate the probability that sort of blind null hypothesis observer will have the same result or better than the real observers in terms of agreement. Maybe we can just show you how that you do that. It's same thing again. This is the test statistic which is randomized. This is the test statistics that has been observed. And we put the data, the results in that empty cell. Do it 1,000 times. Okay. And what we see is that the p-value is 1. And now a p-value of 1 means that of the 1,000 cases that we did here, it was each time bigger, the distance was bigger than the observed distance. Now, a better way of doing this, if we just rerun it, is by not counting the number of times. Yeah, so we first click on the randomized test statistic. We take the observed test statistic result, over there. And now we sort of switch off this option, which says that, do I have to look for bigger than or equal to, or do you want me to look for smaller than or equal to? Because now we are interested in smaller than or equal to. Okay, and then we let the whole procedure run. And now we have a p-value of 0, which actually means in there's not a single case in which my null hypothesis observer had a result which was as good as or better than the real observers. This is, you can say, well, of course, this is not very interesting because there are so many neutral categories. Let's try calculate this for cases in which there are only positive or negative emotions, because that's what we're interested in, because they are more difficult than just the neutral ones. Now, the first thing you have to do is actually take all the sixes out, which you can, you can go to, a medieval monastery and ask a monk to do it for you if it's 420 data, and if it's 4,200 data, you would have to ask probably, I have some experience with this, like three or four nuns would actually do the work for you if you buy them the candles for the church. But anyway, but you can also ask Excel to do some of the work for you. And this is a bit complicated anyway. We are going to illustrate the use of empty cells. So emptiness can be extremely informative. So we will enter an equation that gives you an empty cell if both of the cases here are neutral, and which gives you the value if either one or the other is not neutral. So the equation is equals if and the first rater has a value 6, and the second rater has a value 6. So if both the first rater and the value and the second rater have the value 6, then the cell is empty, which are these two quotation marks. And if that's not the case, then just give me the value of the first rater. See, now you have an empty cell, and you can copy that for the whole range. So here is a case in which there's a 6 and an 8, and there we have the value 6. And now you do the same thing for the second rater, equals if, and the first rater is 6, and the second rater is 6, okay, then it should be an empty cell, and if not, it should be the value here, okay, and then you copy it. See, then if you just run through the whole range, the only thing you'll see are cases in which one of the two is not neutral. They are neutral most of the time. You see, it's a little block. Anyway, just to sort of summarize things, you can then just copy this whole thing here. We're not going to do it. Maybe it's just easier if we're. So you just copy, because these are all equations, which gives you a result in the form of an empty cell. Yeah, anyway, why not? Let's just do it. Yeah, you copy it. And then you paste it in the form of values, and then it's actually easier just by hand to shift the values, so because then the empty cells are easy to see, and then you end up with this as your value range. And now we can actually do the whole thing for data in which you have only the positive or negative emotions. So we first calculate the distance between the two observers for emotions that are either positive or negative, if there's at least one positive or negative emotion. Okay, and then there's a bit too much over there, but yeah. And the sum is, again, it's actually the same thing as we saw here. But now our null hypothesis is that we will compare rater 2 with a blind or null hypothesis rater. So we select the whole range, and we enter equals shuffle. And now we will use this whole range as our database, in which we have a kind of estimation of the And basically, I don't think we have to go through the whole procedure, but now it's the same thing. But now we can test the reliability on the basis of a completely different null hypothesis value. We actually test it for a subset of the data only, which is actually much more flexible. You can do it just for the positive emotions, only for the negative emotions. You can come up with different hypotheses about your null hypothesis, like for instance, it's actually resampled and so forth. But you really have to justify why you are using this particular null hypothesis, and the justification depends on the kind of thing you want to prove. The next topic that we will discuss is quite similar to the reliability issue, and it has to do with social preference. Maybe you can explain the nature of the data again.
Yeah, it's about social preferences of six-year-olds who rated classmates, and they rated them on a three-point scale. And the question was, do you play with this child often, sometimes, or never? And we can show the file. It looked like this. It's in Dutch, of course, but the question was, here were photographs of the classmates, of course. And then we asked, do you play with this child often, sometimes, or never? And the pictures of all the children in class appeared randomly, so we clicked on it, and then the next picture came. So, oh, that's the wrong one. And then we asked, do you play with this child, what I said? And we repeated this test after 6 weeks, and then again after 12 weeks. So in total we had three measurements. And the question is, how stable is each individual child's rating?
Yeah, that's very important that we looked for the stability as the property of an individual child, not of the group as it's usually done. So the goal of this exercise or file is to show the use of resampling in the calculation of stability of ratings in individual children, but also to get to a new or a different definition of what stability is, and related to the issue of the fuzziness of categories. So our file deals with agreement in social preferences. And this is how it looks like. Here are the names of the children who gave the ratings, like Ahmed Sur, or what's the name, Arvis Yamuna, or they're it's incredible. They're all Dutch children. I think there's Chantal. That's a French name, and Diaco is probably African. Kimberly is English. Mark is sort of reasonably Dutch. Anyway, this is a very interesting illustration of the modern world, of the structure of the modern world, population-wise. Anyway, so this is the child who rated the other children. He did not rate himself. So, and it's rated in the form of one, two, or three, sometimes.
Never and often.
And often, okay. And these are the measurements for February, and these are the measurements for April, the same children. And we gave this yellow-colored range the name Preferences 1, I think. Anyway, it will appear in the first model. Yeah, we have to move a little bit. Now, here's Ahmed Sur's judgment or preferences for February. Here are his preferences for April for the same children. So it's very easy now to calculate the distance between what he thought in April in comparison to what he thought about this particular child in February by just taking the absolute distance between February and April and just copying it. And then we see that the distance between April and February is 6. The total maximal distance, because there are 15 children, and the minimum is 1, and the maximum is 3, so 3 minus 1 is 2. 2 times 15 is 30. So the maximum difference between two judgments is 30. So we're going to divide his distance by the maximum distance. 6 divided by 30 is 0.2. And then 1, which is maximal agreement, minus the relative distance, which is calculated here, gives you a simple agreement value for, or stability value for this particular child, which is 0.8. So his agreement percentage is, or percentage of agreement is 0.8. Now what we would like to know, of course, is what is the probability that you have an agreement of 0.8 if your preferences with regard to the other children are just not systematic. If you just have like a general bias, for instance, in general you like children, so it means that you play with them quite often, but you have no particular preference for any child in particular. How can we simulate that? How can we simulate a kind of null hypothesis child who just has general biases with regard to 1, 2, or 3, but no particular preference with regard to specific children? Now the whole thing is a little more complicated than in the first case, because the first thing we would like to know, yeah, maybe you can select it and then zoom into it so we can take a better look. So there are actually three ratings, 1, 2, and 3, and we would like to know the frequencies of each of these ratings in the group of in the total group of children, because the null hypothesis that we will test here is that our null hypothesis rater has a kind of age-specific bias. So he will use the general percentages of the ratings that children of his age use in general. And as a model of the age-specific ratings, we use the total set of ratings in his class. So we use his class as a kind of representative of children of his age, and we calculate the frequencies of each of the ratings as they appeared in his class. So, and maybe you can go back to the data social preferences. This is sort of our database, which represents all the ratings for the children in this class, and that's a kind of representation of the children of his age. Yeah, it's really fast world anyway. So that's a kind of representation of what children of his age are doing. We could have taken the sum of this and April, or we could have taken all the classes. Does not matter too much, but we took just by way of example, the data from February. So if we go back to the model. Now here, if you just double click on the frequency, then we can see what the equation is. The equation is equals COUNTIF in the range that we have called preferences 1, which are the preferences for February, the number of times that category 1 appears, okay? So that's a very simple equation. If you enter, then it immediately calculates or counts a number, which is 98. And then for 2, it's slightly different, it's 61. And for 3, it's 81. So we know that in children of this age, 40% of the choices will be 1s. About 25% of the choices will be 2. And 33% of the choices will be 3. And this gives like an idea of a general age-specific bias. We could also have calculated the gender-specific biases, for instance, if that would have been our null hypothesis. Now, what we need is not the percentages, but the cumulative percentage. So we begin with this percentage, and in the second we have the first plus the new percentage, and of course the last one is 1. So we will use the cumulative percentages to simulate a child who has no particular preference for any specific child in particular, but who just uses the general biases with regard to 1, 2, or 3 that are characteristic of his age. Okay, that's what we will simulate. So we will actually compare two null hypothesis children here, just to show you a difference. The first thing we do is give a random number to each ratings, because these numbers actually represent the rating of children, of individual children. So each child which is rated by our null hypothesis rater is represented by a random number, okay? And it's a random number between 0 and 1. Maybe if you just select it and enlarge it a bit, it's a bit easier to see. Okay. Yeah. So this is a random number, and each time you click on F9, the random numbers will differ. Now we will use this random number to determine whether our null hypothesis rater will give a 1, 2, or 3 value here. And the equation is a bit complicated, but I'll read it for you, I'll translate it for you. It says that if the random number is smaller than the first percentage, which was the 40 percentage for about 0.40 for the first category, then write 1. And if that's not the case, then if the random number is bigger than the first percentage but smaller than the second percentage, then write 2. And if none of these cases occurs, then it's 3. So this is actually, it's a bit complicated, but it's an equation you can just copy and use for your own cases. So it will actually resample 1s, 2s, or 3s on the basis of a distribution that is taken from your empirical data. As I said, it's a bit complicated, but as soon as you have it, it's very easy to copy. So it's copied over here, and then you have, of course, a simulated rating for 15 children and a repeated simulated rating, for instance, after 6 weeks or whatever, for the same 15 children. And then we will calculate a distance, which is the absolute value of the second and the first. And then we will copy that. And it will, actually, it's better okay, and then the sum of the distances here is 12, and the maximal distance is 30, and then 12 divided by 30 is 0.4. Actually, it will change each time. It will change with each random resampling. And 1 minus this number gives you the agreement based on the null hypothesis only. And then if we zoom back to 100%, okay. So here, each time we have an agreement which is based on our random model, and this is the empirically observed model. Maybe we can just very quickly run the simulation. So we compare the simulated agreement with the real agreement, the observed agreement. We'll write it down there. Okay. And then, yeah, we can leave everything, that's okay. And see what... So the probability that our... even with 15 cases, the probability that our null hypothesis rater gives an agreement which is as good as or better than the observed rating is 7 out of 1,000, which is a p-value of 0.007. So it means that our real Ahmed was considerably more stable in his rating than this particular null hypothesis model. So it's very important to note that if you talk about stability, it's always in relation to a particular kind of unstable or whatever rater. And of course, the amount of stability depends on the null hypothesis model you compare it with. So it means that there is no such a thing as stability in an absolute sense. It's always relative with regard to a particular model that you consider unstable or representative of something else. Then we will make them actually not really very, not more complicated, but just give another example. Here's a repetition again of this child Ahmed's judgments in February, April, the distance measure. And now we have, just for the sake of the illustration, we have compared instead of taking the whole class or the whole age group as a kind of knowledge basis, we have taken the values of the child itself as a kind of bias. Because you can compare the child with a kind of null hypothesis model of itself. Because what you do then is you say, well, this particular child has a particular kind of bias. For instance, 60% ones and then 20% twos and another 20% threes. Okay, so this is if it's like a child who likes to give positive ratings, then it's typical of this child. So you use the child as a kind of null hypothesis model of himself. If I'm not mistaken, this is where we had the case. So what we did here is we actually resampled instead of Ahmed's own preferences, which means that we took new samples from his own judgment bias. So we sort of compared it with himself. It's just an alternative technique to show you the possibility of using different null hypotheses. But now, the most interesting thing as far as I'm concerned is what happens. It's actually, you should scroll down a little bit. What we would like to know now is that given this null hypothesis where we take the child's own bias, what is the probability that an agreement of zero occurs? What is the probability that an agreement, the percentage agreement of 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, up to 1 occurs? So what we would like to know is the probability for each possible value of the agreement. And we have just 11. I mean, you could also write down like 100 values, but just cut the whole range from agreement 0 to agreement 1 in 11 little pieces. So we copy the random agreement 11 times, which has already been done, and now we will calculate the probability that our null hypothesis model produces an agreement of an agreement of 0, an agreement of 0.1, an agreement of 0.2, and so forth, which will give us a kind of probability curve for each of the agreements. Okay, so we'll do that in the following way. We select the whole range, this whole range, the green range over here, of you first wanted to calculate the p-value. Yeah, maybe it's better if we just do the translation curve thing. So you take the Monte Carlo option again under the functions, yeah, and then as the recalculate values, you take the whole range of values here, which you compare with each of these possible agreements, yeah, and then you compare it with this range of agreements, and then the place in which you want your results is this, because we prepared it in a way that it should fit there anyway. So you let it run 1,000 times. And then here are the p-values, and the p-values are automatically fed into this column. If you go down a little bit, yeah. See, these p-values are sort of transposed here. And then we calculate 1 minus the p-value, and this gives you the transition curve. And this is the transition curve. And what this transition curve do is actually give you the probability that your null hypothesis model will produce an agreement of 0, 0.1, 0.2, and so forth. But if you look at this transition curve, you see that it's actually very easy to distinguish two parts. One part is this horizontal part, and the other is that horizontal part, which are almost the same. Now, this is the part that you would call the unstable raters, because these children are changing their judgments more, considerably more often, significantly more often than should be expected on the basis of your random model. And these children sort of keep or maintain or conserve their judgments more often than should be expected on the basis of your null hypothesis model. And these agreements are a sort of in-between values. Now, what this curve actually does is it's a calculation of the fuzzy nature of the category stable and unstable rater, because it's quite clear that you have the unstable raters here and you have the stable raters here. And if you look at the form of the curve, if you really want to cut define a boundary somewhere, you would say, well, it's here and it's there, and this sort of part in between is like the fuzzy transition part of these two categories. Now, the interesting thing is that the transition curve will differ, for instance, if you have more cases, if you have less cases. So it actually gives you an objective way of calculating a transition curve. And this is exactly the same curve as is used in fuzzy logic, which is called a membership curve. Because you can have a membership of 0% to the category stable rater. So all these children have a membership of 0% to the category stable rater. All these children with these agreements have a membership degree of almost 1 to the category stable raters. And the children here in between have a kind of fuzzy membership value. And this can be used to do all kinds of interesting fuzzy calculations, which is much more flexible than saying that there's a kind of measurement error here. This is not measurement error. This is an estimation of the real fuzziness of the category stable rating, unstable rating, given this particular null hypothesis model. Quite complicated, but anyway. So we can, if I'm not mistaken, we can go to the leave Ernie and who was it? And I'll go to the final part, if there's which is about discontinuity in longitudinal data. And this is, of course, for developmental psychologists, the most important part. We have two little data sets that we would like to explain, and it's the last part of the presentation. So. It has been quite hard for the audience so far, I'm afraid, but anyway. So the data come from, actually what we did was to study the growth of prepositions used in a spatial context. So we had children, for instance, this girl, Jessica, between the age of 1 year and 7 months to the age of 2 years and 6 months. We just taped the number of spatial prepositions in spontaneous language, and we had like an alternating observation schedule. In principle, we went to the home every 2 weeks, but every now and then we had like intensive periods where we went to the home and made the recording every other day, which means that we can experiment with different intervals. We taped the spontaneous language production, and the question is there a discontinuity in the child's production of spatial prepositions, a discontinuity in the variability of that production? Because if you compare one day with another, there's always variability. It's more or less. But sometimes the variability is gigantic almost, and sometimes it's very small. So we wanted to know, is there a developmental discontinuity in variability? Now, the goal of this presentation is to show the use of random permutation techniques in the studies of discontinuity, developmental discontinuity, and take variability as an example. And these are two things that are actually very hard to do if you use the standard statistical techniques. First of all, it's very hard to calculate or to have techniques for studying statistical properties of variability. And the second thing is that it's very hard to do studies on discontinuity, but we believe that it's relatively easy to do it with the aid of resampling techniques. So let's go to the variability peak of Jessica. She's like 4 now. By the time she will be, I don't know, 25, she won't very much enjoy the fact that her variability peaks have been exposed to. Anyway, so here are the ages, but what we actually did was we took the data of the spatial prepositions, for instance, the first day, 0, 1, 6, and so forth. You can see the graph here. This is the time. And we just the former kind of eyeball statistics method, we estimated the point where we thought a discontinuity could occur. Now, if you look at these data, we thought that the discontinuity is somewhere here, and the vertical line here represents the point where we thought that the discontinuity started. This was just, it was done by another person who had no mathematical methods for estimating the discontinuity. So the point where the discontinuity that we thought occurred begins is marked green, and it's time zero. So we sort of count back and count forward. So we begin at time day minus 100, and then we go up to day plus 240. So we have like 52 data points in a row. So this is the first part of the data. Now we are interested in the variability of the data. These are the original data. And the variability is defined as the absolute, it's one of the definitions of variability. It's the absolute difference of what the child produces today and what the child produces the preceding or the previous observation or session. Okay. So here the difference is, the distance is 1, 5, 2, and so forth. And here you have a plot with the black squares of the variability over time. Now, one of the interesting hypotheses about discontinuities is that it will lead either to preceding or to following successive kind of increase in the variability. If you look at the variability measures, here you see low values of variability, but it seems as if right after the hypothesized jump or discontinuity, they are more high levels of variability. Let's see where. Actually, if you just look at this window, for instance, it seems as if there are more extreme values over here than later. Of course, here there are also extreme values, but the average level is considerably bigger. So the hypothesis that we wanted to test is, are there more extreme variabilities here right after the jump than anywhere else? And is it statistically significant? This can be seen in the next worksheet. It's exactly the same thing: time, spatial prepositions, variability. And now we define the window of actually just 10 consecutive observations. We could have taken 12 or 8, it does not matter, it's just an estimation. And we take the values of the variability right after the discontinuity, which we estimated would be at point zero, okay? So here we have like 10 values. And now we enter a very simple equation which will give us the four largest values in this window. And the equation is equals large, and you open the brackets, you select the range for which you want to calculate the large value, and then you want to have the largest one, which is the first of the large values. So the maybe you can select the whole thing and then zoom in on the whole thing, so we can show the equation a little better. So you see the large value of this range from D19 to D28, and you want the first of the large values, okay? So you enter, and then this, you want the second largest, which means that you have to change the 1 into a 2, which means the second largest. And here you want the third largest of this range, and there you want the fourth largest of the range. And there's the equation. So this will give you the four largest values of this window, which is the window right after the hypothesized discontinuity. We could have taken the five biggest or the three, it does not matter. Anyway, so here you calculate the average of the four largest, the four biggest values right after the jump, and it's 21.25. Now, the null hypothesis is that although there's like an increase in the values of the child's production of spatial prepositions, the actual variability does not change. I mean, the null hypothesis says that the difference between what you do today and yesterday is on average the same as what you did like 6 months ago, if you would have compared 2 days at that time. Maybe we can go back and zoom back to 100%. So the null hypothesis says the distribution of the variability is not systematic. Our hypothesis says there is a systematic effect, namely that you should find higher values, not only higher, but you should find higher values, extreme values, right after the hypothesized jump. We will test this by selecting the same window, because this is a window of 10 values. And in that window of 10 values right after the jump, we will actually place a random selection of 10 variability measures taken from the whole range of variability. Okay, so the equation is equals shuffle, and then we select the whole range of variability and close the whole thing, and then with Control Shift Enter. And then we have like 10 variabilities right after the jump, based on the null hypothesis that it's just accidental where the variability comes. We just repeat. Actually, yeah, maybe it's better if you type in the equations again. So you take the largest value of this resampled set, and you take. So it means that. By clicking on F4, you transform the reference into an absolute reference, because that's easier if you want to copy it. And then we copy it to the three other cells, and we change the reference, the largest value, the second largest value, the third largest value, okay, and the fourth largest value. Okay, and then we calculate the average again, which is the average of the fourth largest or biggest values under the null hypothesis that it doesn't, that it's just completely accidental where the variability values come. So we will calculate the probability that under the null hypothesis the average of the four biggest is as big as or bigger than what we have observed. Okay. So we take the Monte Carlo simulation, we compare this number with that number, and we will write down the results over there. And the p-value is, as you can see, that's great, is 0.02. Which means that at the 0.0 level, there's the occurrence of high variabilities right after the hypothesized jump is statistically significant. Now, this is something which maybe somebody who's really good in, let's say, the classical statistics would also be able to do, but this is something that can be done in a very intuitive way, which is also very, very difficult to do if you have to use the classical techniques, because you have to make very complicated assumptions. And here, the only assumption you make is the null hypothesis assumption, that it does not matter where your variabilities come. And of course, you can make alternatives to this null hypothesis value. You can take subsets or whatever, make it more strict and so forth. But this is a way of showing that the increase in the variability right after the jump is statistically significant in this particular child. Now, the last thing we would like to demonstrate is a bit similar. It's also about the growth of prepositions. Now, we take a different child, Lisa, between 1 year and 4 months and 2 year and 14 months. Again, the same structure of observations. But now the question is there a discontinuity, not so much in the variability, but in the level of the production? Is there like a real jump? This is a bit more complicated. Here are the data of another child, and it's the red dots. And you can see that just that this child really makes a big jump, you see. It's like here for a long time. And then she suddenly produces a high number of spatial prepositions. So here it's easy. Now, the technique that we use to determine a sudden jump is as follows. We actually cut the whole range of data in two parts. And we started with a small part here and then a long part there, and then sort of extended the first part, and then the second part became smaller. And for each of those parts, we calculated a simple linear regression. For instance, through this part, this would be the linear regression line for this part of the data, and the orange line would be the linear regression line for that part of the data. And then we calculated the difference between the last part of the first and the first part and the first point of the second regression line, which is very small here. But now if you extend this window and you enter here, or you end up here, then you see that the difference here is very big, okay, between the two regression lines, and it corresponds exactly with what you see in the forum of the discontinuity. So we used the technique of splitting the whole range into two parts, of increasing length, and calculating the difference between the two parts as a kind of criterion for the existence of a discontinuity. What we found was that the only child who really showed the discontinuity in this way was this child, Helene, and the others did not. Now, if you look at the data of another child, then if you look at the data like this, it's this sort of big, I don't know, cigar or whatever of data or cloud of data. It's like a linear increase, but there are two outliers here, which are a bit strange. But you lose these outliers. Well, first of all, there are lots of programs that just throw the outliers away, and they are the most interesting things, because we avoided things like, we did not count things like if the child would start singing like on, whatever, that was just counted as one on, because it was only one situation. So these data are really reliable. So if you look at the averages, you won't see the interesting thing, which is in the extremes. So our idea was it's much more interesting to look at the extremes, especially the high levels of production, because a high level of production shows that it's possible that a child is interested in, and this could be a criterion of the jump, and not so much the increase of the average. So we use a technique which is called progressive maximum. And what a progressive maximum does is it fixes the first point, and then takes the maximum actually for the first and the second. And then it takes the maximum for the first to the third, from the first to the fourth, and so on. So it's like a widening and increasing window, and it just keeps the maximum for that window. For instance, here, it will keep the maximum until there's a higher maximum there, okay? So it's like an extending window. And the progressive maximum is like a kind of upper level of production, which is like the maximal competence level or whatever, which is another representation of the child's competence than a kind of average here, which we think is much more interesting. Then we apply the same technique of splitting the whole thing in parts and calculating the linear regressions, but not applied to the data, but applied to the maximal, to the progressive maximum. And then, for instance, you find something here for the first line, and then the second line will be this. And then, of course, the difference is again very big. If you would apply this to the averages, you would see a very small difference. But if you apply it to the maximum levels, you see a very big difference. And now we come to the actual statistical part, if I'm not mistaken. So the goal of this last little demonstration is to show the use of resampling and statistical simulation in the study of sudden jumps in extreme values. Not averages, as is always used, but extremes, which are interesting from a developmental point of view. Okay, we go to Lisa's data. Same structure, so we have time, we have estimated a point of the jump. That's where we start. Then the next step is to, we go to the progressive maximum, is to calculate a progressive maximum. Now the equation for the progressive maximum is as follows: equals the maximum of point B2 to B2. Okay? Now if you click on it again and double click on the B2, we make the B2 reference absolute and the other B2 reference is still relative. Now if you compare it, it's going to be clear. If you copy it and paste it, it's going to be clear what happens. For instance, if you just click on this value, now it says it's the maximum from B2 to B11. This will be the maximum from B2 to B12 and so forth. So it's this idea of an increasing window, okay? And I don't know if you can see it on the screen, but the dark blue points are the data, and a sort of whatever it's sort of pink or a color is the maximum. Now comes the hard part. Here's a simulation. So these are the times, these are the data, this is the progressive maximum. And now the null hypothesis is that what you actually see, but it's a null hypothesis, what you actually see is just a linear increase. Is a linear increase. That's a null hypothesis. So the first thing we do is we fit a simple linear model to the data by calculating the intercept with the equation. Maybe you can zoom in on it. That's easier. Okay. Yeah, so it's the intercept given the data and the ages, okay? It's a very simple Excel formula. And the same thing can be done with the slope. It's very simple. It's the slope of the data and the ages. And then you use these two to write down your linear model of the data. If you double-click on it, we'll see what... So it's intercept of the data plus... this moment in time times the slope. It's a very simple linear model. Now, once you have, maybe it's better if you just go back to the 100% zoom. So here's the linear model. If you have the linear model, you can calculate the residuals. And the residuals is the difference between the model and the observed data. And we take the absolute residuals. Now it becomes a bit technical, but I don't have time to explain everything. But anyway, you take the residuals, and then you calculate the same linear model of the residuals, because your null hypothesis says what you see has nothing to do with discontinuities. You're just deceived by these little outliers. It's just a linear model, and it's linear in its increase, and it's also linear in its variability. Its variability may increase with time, or it might decrease, whatever. So you have a linear model of the data, and you have a linear model of the residuals. If you have a linear model of the data and the residuals, you can simulate a null hypothesis model, because it says, well, the real data are like just a random variation around this linear trend, given this linear model of the residuals. So the equation, maybe if you can enlarge it a bit. So the equation is as follows. Yeah, simulated data. So here you use the equation that I explained in the beginning of the talk. It's the normal integer with the predicted linear value as the average and the predicted residual as a standard deviation, times the correction factor. I mean, the correction factor is not something I can explain here, but anyway, so you have to apply this correction factor in order to obtain a variance, a total variance, which is similar to the total variance of your data, because you have to be fair, of course, with regard to the null hypothesis model. So you actually simulate, maybe you can zoom back to 100%. Okay. Yeah, there we are. And if you now click on F9 a couple of times, you will see that your simulated data will change all the time, okay? Now, this is just like a column in which you, if one of these numbers, especially here in the beginning, sometimes it's smaller than zero. You have to transform it to zero with this simple equation. But that's just like a little technical thing. So you calculate a progressive maximum for the simulated data each time you have a new simulated data series, okay? It's the same equation, so each time you click on F9, you have a new a progressive maximum. Now, maybe you should zoom in onto that. Here's a little equation that we had to write for this particular application. If you double click on it, we'll see what it does. Actually, if you're doing research, it's very good to have somebody around who can write little programs in Visual Basic. Not very complicated ones, but just somebody who likes to do it, like you have people who do video recordings or are specialized in that, or people who are specialized in statistics. I mean, if you work on a lab, it's really interesting to have somebody who can write simple Visual Basic things, because they can give you they can write you a simple equation, which this one is called regress distance relative. If you click on Control Shift Enter, because otherwise what it does is it calculates. It will actually go through the data and divide the data in two at all possible points and give you the difference between the two linear regression models, okay? And it will only keep the maximal of the difference. And it will give you the time at which, or the age at which, the observation at which this maximum occurs. And now it turns out that with this algorithm, you end up with an estimation of the point of discontinuity, which is exactly the same as the point that we sort of estimated on the basis of visual inspection. And it turned out to be the same thing for the four children that we studied. So our visual intuition gave a very good indication of where the distinction lies. And it calculates the same thing for each of the simulated data sets. Now, what is interesting is, you can go out with escape of K. Yeah, this is the interesting part of the equation. It tells you the maximal difference between the two linear models of the progressive maximum for the simulated data based on the null hypothesis that it's actually linear increase, and for the real data. And what you want to know is whether your simulation can do it as good as or better than your observation. So we go back to we're almost finished. We will calculate recalculate this whole progressive maximum 1,000 times. So it means that each time you run a new range of simulated data, it will calculate the progressive maximum. It will calculate the point at which the maximal difference is found, and we compare it with the maximal difference that we observed. And we will do it 1,000 times. So it's a bit slower. This is going to be a very good moment for video editing, because we have now about 250 simulations out of 1,000, because it's doing a lot of work. I mean, it's running a new range of data on the basis of the non-hypothesis model, calculating a progressive maximum, over the progressive maximum, calculating the point where you have the maximal difference between the two sub-stages, so to speak, keeping the maximum, and it does that 1,000 times. If you're a real programmer, you can write a C++ program that does it in like 1/10 of, but does not matter. I mean, it's gives you the time to get a very quick cup of coffee, actually, because we are almost finished. And here we are. The p-value is 0.02. So it says that the probability that your linear model, your model of linear increase, with linear increase in the residuals or in the variability, will produce this jump in the maximum level, which is as big as or bigger than the jump in the maximal level you saw in your observations, is 2%, which is highly statistically significant. And it turned out that if you take the jump in the maximum as a criterion for the discontinuity, then we found discontinuity in the four children that we studied. And we found no, except for one child, indication of that if we took the averages. So you have to look at the extremes, but you need this kind of Monte Carlo techniques to do the kind of statistical testing. I'm afraid this is about all we have to tell you today, but if you're interested, actually, you can work with the files and use the files and plug in your own data. And it's really great fun because the basic tools and skills you need for the technique are actually quite simple. So I hope this will be like a starting point of a rich culture of statistical gambling in developmental psychology. But we'll see. Okay, thank you.